And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Another episode of the VanCast, and Harm, you know, I thought that this was going to be one of those where we were going to be in complete contrast from where we were a week ago when the sky was falling. I thought we were so close to getting into this show talking about a three-game win streak and whether or not everything has turned around, which we know it wouldn't have been, but just, you know, we thought maybe we could have a complete positive spin VanCast for one show. And not that this is going to be all negative, because there's a lot of good to talk about. However, a seventh blown two-goal lead in the first 19 games of the season. Just an incredible, incredible defeat, however you want to classify it. But here we are again, buddy.
We are, and it's just funny at this point because at least I guess they're doing it in an entertaining kind of wild back and forth way. I mean, the last thing you could call that game was dull or boring to watch. At least fans got their money's worth, the ones who attended, in terms of an entertaining game. And it's funny because after the first disallowed Vegas 5-4 goal, I don't think you could have found a single person watching the game who thought to themselves, boy, with that second lease on life, the Canucks are going to take advantage of that and end up winning the game. At that point, you could just tell, given the team's history, that they were going to kind of fall short again. And that's exactly what happened. There's this feeling of inevitability when one thing goes wrong, that everything else is going to as well. It just feels like this group is, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this in terms of one mistake and it already being like, oh boy, here we go again.
No, I thought it was going to turn it around. I truly did. Okay. I didn't even get a reaction out of you from that.
Awesome. I thought you were going to continue going.
No, actually, it wasn't just that it was disallowed, but I did think the amount of time it took for them to get to the decision, because it's an awkward one, right? It wasn't a standard one. Oh, it was over the glass. It wasn't, right? The fact that there was a bit of awkwardness to it really gave the Canucks a break. And actually, I think Bruce Boudreau referred to this after, that he thought that the delay was going to be enough to get them going. And how long did it take from disallowed goal to next allowed goal? Like less than 2 minutes. It was amazing just how fast it happened. I don't know if it was more amazing that it happened that way or that the Canucks actually had a two-goal lead in this game to begin with, but it just tells you everything you need to know, that you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. They stare it right in the face. Like they look down the throat of a gift horse and give it right back on a regular basis.
That camera lens, by the way, if he can just toss him on the right side of the defense, that's the most resilience I think we saw out of any player or anything on the ice from the Canucks' end in that third period.
Well, Wyatt was good. He's like, yeah. He says, yeah, camera lens. Let's see you get the team to the Stanley Cup final.
Oh, yeah, it's got nothing on the stanchion. Well, let's see. I think we could construct a D pair with the stanchion and the camera lens at this point. Might defend the front of the net better.
Yeah, that could be their top pair. There's simply no doubt about it. That could be their top pair. And look, there's a lot to get into on the game that isn't necessarily great, right? I mean, you know, we 5 goals again from Thatcher Demko, made some great saves in the first period, but then turned into the Thatcher Demko we've seen of late. You've got the top line, who was just a disaster in its own end. Wasn't just JT Miller, Bo Horvat had his troubles, and they put Brock Besser on that line. He was no better, especially on the game-winning goal. So there's a lot to get in on a weekly basis as to what's wrong, but let's talk about what's right. And one of the guys that you have to just love is Luke Shen. And you wrote a column or an article on him, a feature that was great, just about his what he's been through, you know, prior to coming to the Canucks, during his time with the Canucks, coming back to the Canucks, like all of that. And last night was the perfect launch point, even though you've been working on this for a while, where he takes a puck in the face, has to leave the game, didn't look good at all, comes back, scores a goal, I think the one was deflected, but did so many good things right after coming back. Like, he is everything you want this team to be, because when you look at this team, the one thing that's clear, and we saw it in the game-winning goal, this is the easiest team in the world to play against, right? Like, you can just cruise through the defensive zone or, you know, the opposition's offensive zone. You can get anything you want in the front of the net. You know, Brock Besser's barely going to touch you along with everybody else. Cross-seam passes, no problem. Like, it is Christmas every day playing this team. But Luke Shen is not that guy. And we saw it last night. And unfortunately for him, all of his valiant efforts end up in defeat.
For sure. And I got to say, the way he took that shot off the back of his head, how quickly he got up after that. Like, boy, I think if I took something like that, I'd be down and out for a while. And I wouldn't even want to step back on the ice for God knows how long. And just seeing the way that he was able to power through that and then not only come back, but even when he did return, he was so steady as always, allowing kind of a big part of why Quinn Hughes, I thought, played one of his most dynamic games of the season was because Shen was just so steady in the right moment, being able to pinch in the neutral zone or the offensive end to keep a play alive. One-on-one defensively, rock solid as always. He obviously was rewarded with a bounce on the goal that he had to put the team up 3-2, I believe. It was just an all-around steady effort. And when I think back to his journey, you just can't help but feel really good about how he's been able to preserve through everything that's happened to him. I mean, this is a player who's been through virtually every possible experience in the NHL. I mean, I was talking to him about the initial experience of getting drafted by the Leafs in 2008, top 5 pick. Can you imagine the pressure that comes with that as an 18-year-old kid? He was telling me that as soon as he had the jersey on and had the cap on, went backstage to do the first TV interview, the first question he got was, the Leafs haven't won a cup since 1967. What are you going to do to change that? Like, holy cow, you imagine that. You've just had the jersey on for less than 2 minutes and you're already being asked to be this franchise savior for a totally dysfunctional organization. It's a ton of pressure. And remember too, Luke Shen, you could understand, given how high he was drafted, the expectations of, hey, he was supposed to be this franchise defenseman, but it wasn't really his fault. He was never really going to be that guy. I mean, he sort of mentioned to me, hey, like, he had 29 points in the WHNL's draft year. He didn't even play on the power play. And yet he's in this top 5, and his peers in that draft class in terms of defensemen are Drew Doughty and Alex Pietrangelo. So when he arrives in the NHL, it isn't just you've got to play well, but you're all of a sudden being compared to Doughty and Pietrangelo and expected to live up to that kind of bar. And that's where he told me that he kind of started to stray away from his identity as a player, that he was kind of felt the pressure and weight to do a little bit offensively. And obviously it was a few up and down years in Toronto, and then he gets dealt to Philadelphia in the JVR trade, bounces around a bunch there, Philly, LA, Arizona, then winds up in Anaheim. And this is where I think you could have seen a make or break point in his career. At this point, he's 29 and he's been through second and third chances. He doesn't really have the glory and the pedigree of, oh, hey, he's a top five pick. And so he deserves NHL chances on that merit. And after his first month with the Ducks, he was waived and demoted. And he was basically told, look, we don't really see a future for you here. It's not as if they were sort of telling him, hey, you can play well down in the minors and you'll get another shot. Like, the Ducks were done with him as an NHL player. And they, in fact, some coaches on that team were pushing him that, hey, you're 29, you've 10 years in the league, this is the first time you're going to go down the minors. Sure you want to go down there? They were pushing him to retire. And he's got this young family. He has to make all these two-hour drives to San Diego every day. And just the resilience there and the way that he sort of came back. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about even coming back to Vancouver, the initial adversity he faced. But that was a moment he could have really quit. He had everything going against him. He had every reason to believe that he was done. But to see him kind of coming back and now at 33 years old, despite being the oldest player on this team, he's playing the best hockey of his career. He's kind of getting better with age. It's just such a fuzzy feel good story.
Yeah, you know, it is on so many levels. And when, for me, and not that I want to be Jim Benning where you overpay for character and you overterm for character, but if you gave me one person I'd love to see back here around this team during a rebuild, it might be Luke Shen. And he might be the easiest to move. So I'm not suggesting you've got to just go down with the ship here. But, you know, when you look at it for my money, like the guys I'd love to see around here and anybody else could go would be Pettersson, Horvat, and Shen. And, you know, Pettersson for just pure ability, which is still there and still climbing on a better team, it would be so much better for him. And we'll get into, you know, why he's being deployed the way he is. And then we got to get into the save of the year, right? Because how good was that?
Oh, yeah.
Too bad it didn't lead to something coming back the other way. I mean, Alex Edler, come on. All those times you tried to be a goalie and that right there, your fellow countrymen just showed you up. But for me, it's those three guys. And I look, I know what
I wouldn't have Horvat on my list, though.
Like, I get why, right? Like, I get why, because right now, given the current status, and you may have other reasons. I mean, given the current status, you actually have the ability to move on from him and not go down the rabbit hole of overpaying, overterming, over everything, given the situation you're in, and his value could be at an all-time high. I totally get it. But in terms of people, I believe any organization can win with, right? I mean, if I'm a team looking for a defenseman that could be in my bottom pair, that could climb up and play key minutes in the top four in the playoffs, and I believe I'm a legitimate contender, like Luke Shen is right there, especially at that price point, like just the perfect contract. But everybody would want that guy. You know, I love when you and I were texting each other and you, the data prodigy, referred to Luke Shen as a glue guy, right? When yeah. data guys start pulling out glue guy, okay? Like I'm thinking, okay, we might be onto something here, right? I don't know if there's a data point around glue, but clearly he's impressing the data guys. So, you know, and they can't quantify why they're impressing him. They just know that he's just, you know, he is that guy. And I'm telling you, like, tell me how many times we've come on this show and we've talked about Luke Shen being a problem. I'm waiting, you know, because it just doesn't happen. We can talk about whether or not he should be getting top pair minutes alongside of Quinn Hughes on a nightly basis and whether or not that's good for the team, but it's clearly good for Quinn Hughes. At no point have we gone through that exercise of where Luke Shen needs to be deployed. And we're saying, like, we might philosophically say, boy, how good could this team be if they could get Luke Shen onto a third pair? But we've never said anything negative about his play or his performance, regardless of usage, on a team this bad. Like, think about that for a minute.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And in terms of the glue guy thing, for starters, his glue per 60 is off the charts. I'll tell you that.
What about his expected glue? Is there an expected glue?
Expected glues is amazing. Leads the team by a long shot. But no, in all seriousness, the other thing that was fascinating in kind of doing some research and
Corsi
and
glue. Let's get to Corsi glue.
Corsi,
we can brand that.
That's private analytics. I can't share that one. That's behind the that's going to be eventually behind the athletic paywall.
Dom Lucision only?
Yeah, his model. You're going to have to subscribe glue for that.
We've got a glue model. Yeah.
But no, the other thing that kind of stood out was kind of along those lines was, I think a lot of times, even just to kind of define what a glue guy kind of is and why that sort of means something is, it's a sort of player to me who can bring people together in a dressing room, because I think one thing that's been apparent since Tanev, Markstrom, and Toffoli left is that there hasn't necessarily been that chain link that can connect certain factions of the dressing room together, if that kind of makes sense. Because look, on any team, there's always going to be, whether it's age related or guys that played with each other earlier in their career, there's always going to be, you know, little groups of friends that are especially close with one another. And I think as a team, what you're looking for is for those little groups to eventually just become one big group. And Shen is the sort of player where you look back at previous stops that he's been at in his NHL career, he's always been that guy when it comes to, like, he was the point man for setting up team dinners. He's tried to do that a lot when the Canucks were in Toronto, for example. Him and Tyler Myers are trying to organize and kind of bring the team together. And even in Tampa, the Lightning really relied a lot on him in that kind of role where Shen was telling me that he and Ryan McDonough were the ones that were kind of responsible for putting together the menus, sending them in to the team services guys for when the team would go to restaurants before playoff games, and just how much that camaraderie and that team bonding aspect mattered in the playoffs. Because you need that element to feel an accountability, to fight for one another, to have that accountability for each other, have that feeling of, hey, I don't want to let the guy across from me down. And that's where Shen is, I think, essential. And they just don't have enough of those types of presences in the locker room, I feel, just being in and around the team, even to a lesser extent, when they lost a guy like Troy Stetcher in the 2019-20 season. Like, that was another example of a guy like that where you're looking at players who connect just as well with the veterans as they do with the young guys, right? And that's where, like, Tanev was so, you know, he was a veteran, but Tanev, for example, was so close with Quinn Hughes, and Markstrom had a great connection with Elias Pettersson, and Stetcher was kind of in the middle range as a 26-year-old around that point, where he was really close with Besser and Pettersson and those guys, but he could also connect with the older guys. And the Canucks' current group, I just don't feel like they have enough of those stop gaps in between guys who can connect with everyone and who go out of their way to kind of connect everyone. And we even saw Shen in situations here and there when the clip sort of went viral after Hockey Night in Canada, where Shen's trying to hold JT Miller accountable. Like, who else could honestly try and hold JT Miller accountable? Nobody. That point,
not in that room.
Exactly. And that was really, really important. So it's just telling, especially given his pedigree. He's won back-to-back cups. He actually knows what it takes to win, right? Like, that label is thrown around so much. He actually knows what it takes. And he's just so valuable in that way. And they just don't have enough of that ingredient on this team right now.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And, you know, we probably undervalued that with Tanev. And I don't know what the solution is, right? Because when you go bring in a Jay Beagle, like, glue in one room isn't necessarily going to be glue in another. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know what kind of impact a player at the bottom of a lineup somewhere else has. You bring him in thinking, okay, because he's won a Stanley Cup, you can elevate him slightly in your lineup, which generally isn't a good idea. And you expect him to have the same impact chemistry-wise in your room that he did in another room. And that's just not real, right? And in the case of Tanev, he probably has had that impact in Calgary's room, but they also had some familiar faces around him when he got there. You know, the effect he could have had here was probably underplayed because his injuries and his analytics were declining so much by the time he got out of here. And, you know, it gave him a new lease on life. And, you know, for me, I think that what they had Shen, lost him, got him back, and he's had the same effect. And I don't think there's a path to keep him. And that's my question to you. Like, what are the chances he's on this team at the end of the season? I think very, very low.
I don't think they're very high. The other thing to kind of keep in mind is a player like Shen, a professional who's been through winning environment, who saw what it was like to be in Tampa. He's going to have pride about sort of playing in on a team with the right culture and a team that's headed in the right direction. And I think a big part of why he signed back here in the first place was, well, an issue why he left, a big reason after the 2018-19 season, because after that point, I think a lot of Canucks fans were hoping he'd return. I think the reason in large part was because he was so close with Steven Stamkos for a long time. They'd played together on World Juniors and they kind of, I believe, had lived in the same area in Ontario. So that was alluring, and the chance to win a Stanley Cup. Once he checked those boxes, I think, you know, for starters, the opportunity to play a more substantial role stood out. But also, I think he genuinely felt that the young core was headed in the right direction. And I think he liked the idea of helping usher that next wave, and that he believed in the direction of this franchise. Clearly, that direction hasn't gone in the right way at all. And with the organization kind of in a tire fire situation right now, I don't know why anyone would really feel a strong urge that, hey, I really, really want to be back, especially when you're Shen. You're going to be highly sought after in the offseason given the quality of your play. But also, and this is, I kind of wanted to touch on something you mentioned earlier with the whole leadership aspect and how you can't fix your room just by bringing in a Beagle or a Roussel. I think the important thing to always keep in mind when it comes to leadership and kind of a lot of those intangibles are they need to be backed up by on-ice play. And I think that's the distinguishing factor where, look, if Luke Shen was struggling and he was the seventh, eighth defenseman who couldn't keep up and he had no wheels, like that, his words then wouldn't mean much because he's not able to kind of back it up with his play. And I think that's always a big respect factor, is you've got to be able to genuinely be an impact player. You can't just be a fourth line guy who gets caved in all night in his own end, and your only job is to win faceoffs and kill the odd penalty, and otherwise you're a liability, and then expect that guys are going to rally around you as a major focal point leader. Like, that's just not going to happen. And I think that was part of the key behind those three aforementioned Tanev, Markstrom, and Toffoli, was they're also playing such pivotal roles. Where Tanev was on the top pair next to Hughes, Markstrom was your starting goalie, Toffoli was an essential top six piece. And I think that's essential, because I think back to all those Oilers teams back in the day where they were such a disaster, despite getting the first overall pick every year. And they would consistently harp on, oh, the culture's wrong. We don't have a culture of accountability. And they were right. It's not that they were wrong, but they thought the solution was to bring in all these like fourth line guys and bottom pair defensemen with solid intangibles, and that they could somehow steer the ship. The problem was when they named, for example, a washed up Andrew Ferentz, for example, as a captain for a bit. And this was, I was trying to remember whether it was a Twitter thread or whether it was a podcast. It's interesting hearing him kind of explain that his, like, at a certain point, he just couldn't keep the room in control, because how much could he honestly say as a bottom pair guy when the top players all of a sudden were able to kind of look down at Ferentz and kind of be like, well, what do you really do for this team? And I think that's one thing to, you know, it's a bit of an aside from the Shen conversation, but I think it's important as we kind of discuss culture and accountability in the state of this team going forward, is it really has to, that responsibility largely lies with your top players. And it helps when you have your entire roster buying in, but really that tone is a top-down sort of thing. And that's why I think it's so hard to kind of build and fix that sort of thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And when you look at his numbers last night in terms of his shot share, scoring chances, like, he was sitting there at 66.7%, you know, goes for all of it. Like, he delivers.
On a night where they were crushed. And I think that's the other thing too, that
16 minutes on the ice, 5-on-5 minutes. And like, he delivers.
Absolutely. And again, on a night where the team was crushed, and that's the other thing that I kind of wanted to get into was, yeah, they had the blown lead, and we can talk about the third period meltdown, and it says a lot about how fragile they are as a group and how one mistake compounds to multiple. But really, after the first two periods, I didn't think they had much business being in the game in the first place. And to me, the first period was really telling as well.
Okay, well, listen, before you get too deep into it, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, let's dive in. You know, we needed a positive block harm.
Yeah, we
did.
Don't
take my block and make it negative. Okay, during the break, you can come up with the glue metric, but it, you know, come on, let's finish it. Let's finish a positive block. All right, when we come back.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, so Harm, like let's get back to the house of negativity here. Well, no, let's not do that. But they were fortunate. There's no doubt that to get into the midway point of that game, even though you know they gave up the two goals within a minute, overall they were fortunate to be where they were for much of this game.
For sure, especially the first period stood out to me because it was an example to me of I didn't even think the Canucks played that poorly. When it came to their own mistakes, how they were managing the puck, breakouts, like I thought they were actually playing pretty decently, especially in the first 5 to 10 minutes where their passing was crisp. And yet it was a reminder that even when the Canucks are competent and playing polished by their standards, they can still be overwhelmed. Like the shots were 17-8. Vegas took control of that period despite Vancouver, again, not playing that poorly. And that was really concerning to me because it was a reminder that the Canucks aren't even in the same league as the top teams in the league when they're kind of playing up to their standard. And the biggest thing that stood out along those lines was the speed difference. It just felt like that was one area where the Canucks had no answers. They had no ability to sort of fight back against that, where as soon as the Canucks would lose possession in the offensive zone, I think that was one part where the Canucks could maybe make the first couple passes in the first period through the defensive and neutral zone. Vegas defended the line really well, and the Canucks couldn't really connect their passes in the offensive zone. And as soon as that would happen, the Golden Knights were just off to the races. They were counterattacking so quickly, not only in terms of their speed, in terms of their feet, but how quickly they connected plays, how tightly and organized they could support the play in the puck so that they consistently provided easy passing outlets. That was such an organized, well put together team where the speed was just like it was night and day. It felt like the analogy that I kind of drew was it was like they were zipping around 120 on the highway and the Canucks were in the slow lane doing 80, just their car couldn't do anything over 80. There was one sequence around the 6 minute mark of that first period, which was, I was like, wow, where it stood out to me because it wasn't a player like Jack Eichel or Chandler Stephenson or anybody else in Vegas' top six making the difference. It was William Carey on the fourth line, where after a neutral zone faceoff, Carey, within a mere matter of seconds, was able to get behind the defense. Vegas got a controlled entry from his fourth line, which how many times did the Canucks honestly get controlled entries and rush chances from a non-Pettersson line? Anyway, Carey got behind and couldn't convert on the partial breakaway, but then just seeing Kolesar and Howden just hound the puck, close so quickly with their speed, recover the puck, zip the puck around the offensive zone, low to high, back low. They were able to jam grade A chances. And then it was funny because the Canucks then had a chance to counter. They picked up the puck and their transition was so slow They enter the offensive zone. They took a feeble shot, which was deflected away. And as soon as Pietrangelo picked up the puck, it was boom, boom, two passes. And they had all the time and space in the world to generate a scoring chance off the rush in the slot. Like, that was the sort of sequence where I was looking at it and going, I can't identify the Canucks making too many mistakes in that sequence. They were just flat out overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, the speed gap against selected teams, whether it's Calgary, whether it's Edmonton, who are like, it clearly shows when the Canucks play them. And they don't have a strategy necessarily on how to mitigate it and slow it down. They just want to play the same way, right? And, you know, we've talked about this before in terms of Bruce Boudreau. He's not going to be necessarily changing much. He's going to be kind of going down with the ship. Let's talk a little bit about Vancouver's top line, theoretical top line, right? It started as Garland, Miller, and Horvat, with Horvat in the middle, and then eventually Garland left that line, and they added Brock Besser to that line for the third period, or maybe some late stages in the second period as well. A line that looked like they were struggling big time. You know, I know that plus minus isn't always telling, but as far as JT Miller's concerned, on the ice for another four goals in this game, that winning goal, like I've talked about it a couple of times, where Brock Besser just kind of cruised through the slot, made it so easy for the rebound. Where are we with that group? Why does a group that seemingly has all the physical effectiveness, and we saw in Besser's case last year, he had positive two-way results. What is going on here with this group?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I think,
Look, we love what Horvat's doing offensively. Yeah. We love what Horvat's doing offensively. But, you know, to net out even on a nightly basis is troubling.
Well, that's part of the story, is Miller and Horvat can create offense together, but defensively they are still such a high event duo. And quite frankly, I don't think they're well suited at all to sort of defend against top lines the way they're playing right now. I think there isn't a ton I can blame Boudreau on in terms of the season as a whole. I just don't think that he has the right horses to field a winning team. But one of the biggest miscalculations of the season that he's made, I believe, was entrusting Miller as kind of his matchup guy. And not to pick on him specifically, because now he's been with Horvat, as you mentioned. And the bigger point is, I don't think Boudreau's realized that Pettersson has to be his go-to guy for defending against top lines, for head-to-head against the opposition's best players, because against Jack Eichel, that was really the game right there, was that Eichel line and how they dominated the Canucks. They had 15 minutes head-to-head against the Horvat-Miller line, and in those minutes, we're talking 10-5 shot advantage, 7-1 high danger chances, and 3-0 in terms of goals. That's on a night where you lose 5-4, and they pot 3 against you. You lost the game right there in that battle alone, and I've counted 10 games where that Miller line has been the clear matchup trio against an opposing top line. And there were games where, you know, he was able to, on occasion, hold, for example, when the Penguins came in town, he held Crosby in check. I thought he held his own against Duchesne's line in the Nashville one, where it was one of their better games despite them blowing the lead and losing. In the win over Anaheim, I thought he fared decently against Trevor Zegras. New Jersey completely dominated them, but despite that, I thought in that game, Miller's line was totally fine against Jack Hughes at 5-on-5. But man, there have been other games where that top line hasn't just been beaten, they've been dominated. I mean, you look back at the Toronto game with Austin Matthews, the games where we've seen the Tage Thompson line against a Miller, even against Kopitar in that LA game where the Canucks won, Kopitar's line had a 10-1 edge in shots. Like, I sort of added up the games where Miller's been the clear go-to matchup trio. They've been outshot 55-23 and outscored 5-1. And I look for starters, like, I'm not trying to dump on Miller, right? Like, at a certain point, it's on the coach for understanding his players and putting them in a position to succeed. Like, I don't want this to be a dumping on Miller thing. I think at this point, it's on Boudreau to recognize that it's time for Pettersson to get this opportunity. I think the reason we haven't seen Pettersson get this opportunity is, you go back to the conversation that we kind of had with him in Whistler in training camp, and sort of flat out said, look, as long as Kuzmenko's on that line, until I can trust him defensively, despite the fact that I trust Pettersson to play tough minutes, I'm not going to use that trio. Well, I think we're at the point now, especially when you already have one of your better two-way wingers in Ilya Mikheyev on that line, and you're looking at that, looking at those results, outshot 55-23, outscored 5-1 with that Miller line in a tough matchup role. You've got no choice but to roll the dice there. You've got to live and die by your best players at this point.
Yeah, but is there a case to be made of putting Kuzmenko, somebody else on, other than Kuzmenko, on that line?
No, they've been playing too well offensively together, and they create off the rush. I don't want to tinker with that at all. So, like, it can't get any worse. Especially again when you have Mikheyev as a defensive safety net. If you have two really high end defensive pieces on that line with Pettersson and Mikheyev, I think you can gamble a little bit there with Kuzmenko, because at least he'll give you something offensively.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree. We'll get into that a little bit deeper on the other side, plus Thatcher Demko and previewing the upcoming road trip when the VanCast returns.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
So, Harm, back to the current top line and how it finished in the third period. Besser got elevated to that line after opening up the game on the third line. What do we make of Besser's two-way impact? Yeah, he's got a couple of goals here now, but just in terms of that powering his overall play.
It's been porous. I mean, you look at the underlying numbers and the team's just been territorially dominated when he's been on the ice at 5-on-5. I had a chat with him on Sunday. I've got a couple theories in terms of what's gone wrong. I'm curious to hear your sort of take on it first. What are you seeing in terms of the way he's playing and maybe what's missing?
Well, I'm seeing a player that's used to playing in the offensive end a little more than he's playing. And as a result, you're just seeing him get exposed, because defensively, there's been times where I've seen him having to play low and, you know, replace a center in the defensive zone. There's been times I've seen him lose puck battles along the wall, not being able to take away cross seam passes. There's so many things with his game right now, but overall, I just don't think he's physically engaged. He's not playing with any level of confidence. And I know this sounds like it's general, but if he could just have, and he's never been a player with a tremendous amount of bite, but he's been able to tie up sticks. Right. He's been able to get inside position. Right. He's been positionally sound at various times when he's had a better two-way impact. He is none of those things right now.
Absolutely. I think what you mentioned in terms of the battles is massive, because I had a chat with him on Sunday after practice, and this was after he was coming off of his two goals against the Kings, and he's feeling pretty good about his game. And I was just having this kind of conversation with him and asked him about how he just sort of felt generally. And he said one of the biggest things that he continued emphasizing that he really wanted to drill down on was starting to win those little battles, whether it be along the wall or on the forecheck again. Because when you step back and look at what he brings to the table, when he's played his best hockey in seasons past, that's been such a strength of his game. I remember heading into last season, for example, I think Instat had some of their private data, and they posted some of the 2021 NHL leaders in terms of the forwards who were the best at winning puck battles. Brock Besser was surprisingly up there, along with some pretty high end two way names. That was what stood out to me about, for example, in the 2019-20 season, why he was so successful on the lotto line. In the 2021 season, why he was the club's best forward and was putting up 49 points in 56 games on top of a positive two-way impact was Besser's not going to bring really much of anything to the table in terms of dynamic ability or necessarily being a guy who is stripping pucks and backchecking a ton in his own end and being Patrice Bergeron in that way. How he was able to drive two-way results was using his kind of frame and not necessarily being an imposing physical presence, but just being stronger than guys, winning body position, and coming away with the puck on a consistent enough basis. And I think that's the biggest thing that's been missing with this game right now. And what was interesting was he mentioned to me, a lot of times for offensive players, they need to score the goals to, but before they sort of feel the extra pep in their step, before they get kind of like that energy back, that gives them that sort of that wave of confidence to all of a sudden be starting to win puck battles and things like that. Like I've noticed that a little bit with JT Miller, for example, is that when he's going offensively, that's when a lot of the other parts of his game are growing as well. Brock Besser, interestingly, seems to be the opposite. He says that he kind of derives offensive confidence from his ability to win battles because that's how he is able to keep plays alive in the offensive zone. That's how he feels like he's actually able to contribute to a line and feel that, hey, I'm actually helping my line mates create offense instead of just being this complimentary piece that's floating around.
Do you really buy that?
By what?
Well, like the suggestion that his defense drives his offense. I think that's what coaches like to hear. I think that's bullshit. He has always proven to be a bit more complete player when he's going offensively, not the other way around, because then you can lean on that other side of your game. He's been such a wildly offensively inconsistent player, and injuries have contributed to that. But I just see it the other way around. And I think at times he's talked about it the other way, where like you talk to him after he scored two goals, but there's been times when he's just not going on any level offensively, and he will tell you how it's for him, so much of his confidence comes from his offense. So I don't see that as a guy that, you know, does all the little things when he's not scoring. I see a guy that his shoulders are down. There's no smile. There's no pep. There's no nothing when he's not going offensively. It's stunning to me how the Lotto line was such a good line performing at both ends of the ice, and generally because they were playing offensively. And two-thirds of that line, JT Miller and Brock Besser right now, are this bad defensively.
Well, it also says, I think, a lot about how much Pettersson was driving that line as a two-way piece. But yeah, I think, you know, a couple interesting things there. I think it could be a bit of a chicken and egg thing where it's like, you know, You could totally be right on that. Regardless, they're so connected. In terms of if Besser wants to, even if Besser's primarily motivated to score goals, he's not going to do it and create that offense unless he's doing those other little things.
I'm not saying he's primarily motivated, right? Like it's not about that. I think he does care about both ends of it. I just think that when he's scoring, he feels so good and it affects the other parts of his game, as opposed to his process is so good and eventually it's going to lead to offense, right? When he's not scoring, he understands that is what he's expected to do and what defines his game. And when he's not doing that, he feels an internal pressure to do it, which he should. And, you know, he's talked about 30 goals. He hasn't talked about, you know, what his relative Corsi looks like or his expected goals look like. You know, he'll say certain things about 200-foot game, but generally when he talks about his goals, it's 30-goal season. It's staying healthy all season. And when those things aren't happening, it affects every ounce of his game as opposed to falling back on good habits and good process that will eventually lead to him scoring. You know, it seems when he does break out, it generally tends to be so random as opposed to inevitable. Like I know Drancher's always fond of saying, yeah, eventually the numbers will work themselves out and, you know, your power play can't stay this bad for this long and your penalty killing can't stay that bad for that long. Yeah, but when he scores, it seemingly comes out of nowhere. And, you know, that may have happened in this case, so we're not seeing the residual effect on the other ends of the ice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can totally buy that argument. The other thing that sort of sticks out is Besser seems to be the sort of player which, and it's problematic considering how injury prone that he is, but he's always he always strikes me as a sort of player that's affected by missing games more than other players, if that kind of makes sense. Like when totally there's a layoff, it just, I think there are a few elements for why, but it just always feels like, I remember, I can't remember if it was his sophomore year or his third year. I think it was his sophomore year when he was coming off the back injury. I remember the first 10 games, he just, after that electric rookie year, he just looked totally lost and like a shell of himself. And it always feels like there's this really elongated 10 game sort of stretch where he needs, like, it takes that long for him to get back up to speed. And there are, I think, a few elements at play, because I asked about that specifically too. I think for starters, and he wouldn't say, like, he didn't admit this much, but I think part of it is obviously his skating, where he's slower than most players. And when you take him out of game shape, like it just affects him that much slower. He's that half a step even slower, which is a huge issue. The other part of it is the flow aspect. And this is what he was sort of saying was, when he sort of came back after the hand injury, it wasn't so much that the hand was bothering him, but just the flow of the game. He sort of felt lost, which is important, because with Besser, since he doesn't have the foot speed to really keep up, he relies on efficiency and reading the play and being a step ahead mentally, so that he's taking the right routes and angles to make an impact that way. And so that he's relying on his brain rather than his feet. Well, when he's missed that much time and he hasn't played in preseason and he's just out of the flow of it, he's in his head all of a sudden. And now he's not only a step behind physically, but he's a step behind in his reads as well. And that's why he sort of becomes invisible and you see a lack of engagement. And again, it's a really big issue because he is so injury prone. So you're kind of always expecting him to be in and out of the lineup this often. He has to figure out a way to sort of cut down that latency, cut down that lag period of him out of the lineup and cold and I'm out of the swing of things to, oh, I'm back playing some of my best hockey. It's just, it's too long between those two phases of him.
I'll be honest with you, because this organization's got to make a lot of decisions. The second he gets on an uptick offensively, I would trade him flat out. They have to. They're in a position to. I don't know that he'll ever be the consistent player Vancouver wants and needs, and he might find that somewhere else. And when I say the Canucks should trade him, it's not a shot. It's as much for him as it is for the club. The club needs to move some core pieces. They can save themselves $6.7 million per. I get that it's a short-term deal. I don't think he will ever be the player he could be here. And if he goes and becomes that player elsewhere, people will say, oh, they never should have traded him. But remember, opportunity cost. What could you do with that money that you're paying him currently? He's as soon as he gets on that uptick, he is tradable and he needs a change of scenery. It's not going to go for him here the way Canuck fans want it to go and the way he wants it to go. And they've got to make this decision with a lot of players, but they're in a position to move him. And I think we've seen what we need to see from Brock Besser as a Vancouver Canuck. I don't know that he'll be that guy again. And again, people are going to say, I'm down and I'm taking a shot at him. It's not that. But for his benefit, it would also help. And I don't think the Canucks would be lesser off if they spend that money wisely.
Yeah, it's definitely something to consider. And I think that was part of the bet by management last offseason, is when they signed him to an extension. His qualifying offer was such a difficult thing to kind of such a difficult obstacle and a point of uncertainty at a time where so many teams were so worried about their cap situation and worried about unfavorable potential arbitration rulings. It really weighed down on his trade value. And I think what management was kind of hoping was he can, like, it, they were hoping to kind of kick the can down the road a little bit in terms of the long-term decision of whether he's part of this group or not, hoping that if he has a big season, it'll lift his trade value and they'll be in a position to potentially net something back. Because I'll say this, I really believe that if there was an opportunity opportunity to kind of dangle him for a decent top four right-handed defenseman, that they would have taken that kind of opportunity in the offseason. That trade, that sort of hypothetical trade that we've talked about so long of moving a winger, whether it's Besser or Garland for a top four defenseman, it just doesn't exist given the way those players are perceived in value, especially considering the cratering value of wingers as a whole, but also how rarely we see top four defensemen moved. But yeah, I mean, it's getting to a point where even just to open up cap space and chart a new direction for this franchise, you've really got to be thinking about his future, about Garland's future, about Horvat's future. You've really got to start dismantling this core group of players.
Before we talk about the Canucks' average goaltending, let's talk about their stellar goaltending. Elias Pettersson showing Alex Edler how it's done. Like, that was incredible.
Nuts, right? And it was funny because it was yet another sort of moment of fleeting brilliance from Pettersson as the house around him kind of burns down into a pile of rubber. It was just kind of a fitting snapshot of the season. And watching the way he played, it's just all brains. The way that he was in the blue paint and initially kind of squared Eichel up, taking away that shooting lane, he was begging Eichel to make that pass across. So when Eichel made the pass across that Pettersson knew that he was forcing Eichel to make, it wasn't even a hesitation. He was already exploding to his left. He had baited Eichel into that pass to Marchessault, and then just boom, left outstretched pad save. Man, that was awesome to see.
Yeah, no doubt. Now as for the other goaltender, what do we make of Thatcher Demko's play? Because he did some really good things in the first half of that game. And, you know, for me, when I look at his game, I want to see tightness, right? I just don't want to see pucks squeeze through him. And there was a chance there. There was a deflection right in front in the slot that kept the Canucks ahead. But once they scored, it ended quick, right? Like, they were up 1-0, like I said, and there were a couple of chances where we've seen pucks squeeze through and they weren't in that moment. But then right after that, like I said, as soon as those goals went in, bang, bang, you could see his play falling back to what we've seen so far this year. When I thought, based on what we saw in his last start and the first half of this start, that maybe the worm was finally turning. Do you take the good that we've seen and think, okay, that's there, it's coming back? Or do you take how it finished and think, here we go again?
I'm still worried about him, to be totally honest. Yeah. I was hoping...
I read your column on it. Yeah.
Even going back to that LA game where he made 36 of 37 saves and he was really, really sharp, there were still moments where that could have really gone wrong for him and the team, where there were a couple of crossbars and there were two early whistles where he wasn't able to sort of really freeze the puck and what should have been goals for the Kings, Demko was essentially saved on by the refs blowing those early whistles. So he had some bounces go his way, which you need that, I think, even just to just get back on track. For a struggling goaltender, that was as well as he could have played against LA. But then we saw in this game, in the first couple periods, I was thinking, man, he's back. I was like, the way he was making saves off the rush, Vegas was operating full throttle coming down on the Canucks. And I was mentioning in the first period how the Canucks were simply overwhelmed and how they, in all honesty, they weren't playing that poorly in the first period. But the second period, Vegas was just fully in control. The Canucks were kind of regressing back into their old habits. And Demko was unbelievable. But as soon as the 4-3 goal was scored, that's where it kind of unraveled on the last two goals. He's such a good puck handler. And on the fourth goal, it was just so surprising to see a mental lapse like that where you only
firing it up the middle.
Yeah. It, like, you're up one goal. Like, Demko never makes that mistake. You know what I mean? Like, you never see him make
that. Put it off the wall. There's no doubt.
I've always thought about how sharp of a puck handler he is. And yet for that mistake to happen in that moment and for him to not be able to squeeze the post and That was a really, really soft goal for Smith to get, and shocking defensive coverage on the fifth goal, for example.
Yep.
Even with Stillman and Besser, but it just went in too easy through his legs. And when that happens, I think you're just kind of back to square one in wondering about where his game is at, where his confidence level is at, because for as much as the Canucks didn't deserve to win that game at all, he'd kind of put himself in that spot to regain confidence. And I think it highlights how both for him and the team, again, just the fragility, because I'll take a step back and talk about the team again here. After that LA win, I can't believe how Bruce Boudreaux was calling it their best, most complete 60 game performance of the year. I was like, were we watching the same game? I mean, the Canucks, I think, were fine. They played well enough to win, but they allowed nearly 40 shots. They had those crossbars and those early whistles that bailed them out. Demko was unbelievable. The high danger chances at 5-on-5 were 13-7 for LA. I think when you have, and I'm curious to kind of, you know, hear what your read of the situation is, but when a coach is looking at a performance like that against the Kings, and he's having to kind of prop it up as, wow, I was so impressed. That was one of our most complete efforts of the season. I think that's a coach trying to convince his players and make them feel better about themselves when they're clearly not, when they're clearly struggling to find their game as a whole. Because usually when good teams are winning games, coaches try and downplay how well the team's playing just so that they're, just so that they stay level-headed. And it's telling to me that even when the team's playing, you know, playing all right and they're winning games, that Boudreaux's, you know, feeling the need to kind of pump their tires and make the group feel really good about themselves.
Well, because they are fragile, right? And he hasn't held back when they've been bad. He didn't necessarily hold back last night in the here we go again type of theme, right? So, you know, you kind of got to have it both ways. There's going to be times when you've got to cut and there's got to be times where you've got to cure, right? So I'm not surprised, right? We've got other coaches. You know, when Travis Green was here, it was generally a lot more muted in either direction, right? When they won or when they lost, right? Mm-hmm. So certainly Gabby's a little more emotional with his approach to it all. So when he's frustrated, you're going to hear it. And when he feels the need to pump their tires a bit, he's going to do it, right? To let them think that, yeah, it is right there for you. You know how to play this way. You're capable of playing this way. You're showing us you can play this way. But this stuff is on a knife's edge, man. And when you look at last year, okay, for as good as Pettersson has been now, and for as much that was wrong with the team then, you know, for the 27 games before Travis got fired, you could make the case that if Pettersson was playing 6 out of 10 level hockey instead of 2 out of 10 level hockey, Travis Green may have kept his job. And right now, you can make the same case for Thatcher Demko. We know how bad this team is, but that doesn't give Demko a pass for the types of goals that have gone in. And if Thatcher Demko was playing 6 out of 10 hockey at, you know, to his 10, like what that looks like, right? There's been games where average goaltending would have got him a win. And that hasn't happened in some games. Are the Vegas Golden Knights better than the Vancouver Canucks? Obviously. But Bruce Boudreaux is going to lose his job. We all understand it's just a case of when. But if Thatcher Demko had played average, and average was how he played the last 2 months of last season, right? Versus the first half where he was incredible. Like the last 2 months, if he was playing that level of hockey today, the Canucks probably have 2 to 3 more wins and we're having a different discussion. But that's how thin it is. Yep.
You're 100% right.
And we get where again, I'm not trying to say the rest of the Canucks team is good now and that they're losing games because of Demko. And I'm not trying to say the rest of the team was good in the first 2 months of the season last year. You know, like there is more to it, but understand how one player can make such a difference in a game like this.
100%, especially when it's your goaltender. Especially, I think, on that, thinking back to the road trip, whether it was, I think the Minnesota game really kind of stood out to me because it kind of preceded the meltdown in the home opener at a time where if they had won that game against the Wild, could have swung the momentum where I think at that point the Canucks would have had, I think, points in 2 of their last 3 games and they would have been able to go back to you know, go back to home having won a game and at least salvage something from that road trip. When Demko sort of fell short in that game against the Wild, where the Canucks, I thought, considering the circumstances, last game of a grueling road trip, 3 games in 4 nights, when he came, you know, that's an example of a game where when he falls short there, it just deflates, has such a deflating impact. Not that it's on him specifically, but that's a moment where I thought the Canucks needed him to step up. And there have been a lot of games interspersed here and there where he hasn't been able to bail the team out. The one thing I will say is, and I know, you know, I'm not trying to counter what you're saying, because the way, you know, you laid it out perfectly, but it is interesting to kind of look at a team like, let's say, the Nashville Predators. The Predators are pretty much the poster boy right now of a middling franchise. They're, nobody considers them a good team, let alone a great or an elite one. Well, it's interesting to me that the Predators for most of the season have had UC Saros playing below 900, right? I think just recently now he ticked slightly above it. But for most of the season, he was basically having a Thatcher Demko type season, where he's an elite goaltender. He was pretty much one of the only reasons the Predators made the playoffs last season. The team, despite his underperformance, though, was able to at least weather the storm, and they're still in the thick of the race, right? They're 9-8-2, which isn't great, but they've at least given themselves a chance to continue fighting. Now, again, Saros has been a bit better than Demko, but it hasn't been a big difference. That, to me, is also a big difference, where there's a difference between being 9-8-2 when your goaltender is struggling and being 6-10-3 when your goaltender is struggling, especially when I look at a team like Nashville and the Canucks should be, there's no excuse for the Canucks not to be at a similar level as the Nashville Predators when you look at these teams on paper. So 100% Demko's let them down. 100% he hasn't been good enough. The tough part about it too is it's not as if there's one sort of technical flaw that you can immediately sort of point to. There's no quick fix that Ian Clark can just have a couple goalie ice sessions with Demko and sort of patch things up. This looks like the sort of thing that it could take, it might take some time to resolve. And if that's the case, this team's in such grave trouble.
Yeah, I mean, we thought that this deal was already exceeding its value, right? That they were on the good end of it, and certainly hasn't played out that way this particular season. I mean, last night was a perfect example. Vegas is the better team, had more shots, had more scoring chances, but a point was there for the taking, if not two. And you can't complain about goal support, right? Because we always hear that, oh, Spencer Martin gets all these goals and that Thatcher Demko doesn't get any. 4 goals should be enough to win. It just shouldn't, today's NHL. And, you know, once again, it wasn't last night. Quickly before we go, look ahead to this road trip, because we can't even look at it from a playoff perspective that, oh, they need to win 2 out of 3 to make it a successful trip. It's not even about that anymore. So, and you're playing 2 exceptional teams in Colorado and Vegas, and then it becomes must win on Sunday, but must win for what? I don't even know. It's the second end of a back-to-back. So,
must win for 11th in the Western Conference.
Must win so that we have something different to talk about on our next fancast on Monday. We could come off a win. That would be very nice. But anyway, look, this was fun. If you haven't had a chance yet, though, seriously, get on The Athletic. Make sure you get into the Luke Shen feature that was very good, along with Harm's feature on Thatcher Demko last week. And on another publication on Rob Williams has talked about it. He, like Shen says, this has nothing to do with systems. It has nothing to do with coaching. It's purely about a lack of effort. So get on The Athletic and check out Harm's piece, because he's a fascinating guy who's been through a lot. Not you. You haven't been through a lot. You're but, you know, we want to see. I'd love to see him here. I just don't see a scenario where he's here after the trade deadline. As for us, follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Make sure you subscribe, leave a rating and a review. You can subscribe to The Athletic's NHL YouTube channel at youtube.com/The Athletic Hockey Show. Our Black Friday sale is now. Get a new subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 12 months. Before it was $6. Now it's $1 a month for 12 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. You going on the trip, bud?
I'm not going to subject myself to, it's like, I swear every time I go on a fall road trip.
Don't act tough. It just alternates, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think Dranch is going on this one either, but
oh.
I was on this exact road trip the Colorado Vegas swing last season as well. And that was basically, like, I don't know if you remember, the first Colorado game was the worst game I've ever seen the Canucks play. And that trip as a whole, then they had the epic blown lead against Vegas. Like, that was the death of their, the death of an end of Travis Green right there. I don't know what it is, the first road trip and the one in November last season. Every time I'm on the road, it just, there's just chaos and tire fire around me. So I don't know, maybe I got to get back on the road more just for the Connor Bedard effort here, but no, I'm not on this road trip.
All right, Vegas is a fun town, buddy. You're missing
I've
out.
Gone twice in the last 12 months, so I've had enough of Vegas.
Are you old enough to gamble?
Yes. I didn't, though.
All right. Thanks for listening. Again, VIPs are the best there is. We will be back on Monday.